Welcome to the Created to Work podcast, Modern Day Daniels, where we believe we're made in the image of a God who works. How does this belief shape what we do Monday to Friday? Well, that's what I'm trying to discover as I talk with marketplace leaders who, just like the biblical prophet Daniel, are impacting their communities by incorporating their faith into their work.
I think the words like integrity and faithfulness and persistence and somehow melding together heart and mind, or IQ and EQ, you know, to the glory of God, that has to be seen what success is about.
But thank you so much for taking the time. I was definitely very excited, to get the chance to talk to you and your work, Dr. Garber. And I sent you over some questions beforehand, kind of some ideas, and you know, I'll be typing over here.
Very impressed with all that, Josh. You need to know.
What's that?
I was very impressed with all that. You need to know.
So, oh yeah. Okay. Great. Those are literally questions from our group. So we just record the questions and things that people are asking. So it's just real, you know, questions that we're having. So
wonderful.
The main question that I kind of start with on these things that, you know, within the conversation, is, you know, how will being a person of faith make you more successful at the work itself that you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the pregnant word in the question, Josh, is the word successful, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's probably the contested word, or the really weighty word. Because what does it mean to be a success, and what does successful life look like? And, you know, we live in a world of the flesh and the devil, and, you know, for centuries and centuries and centuries, and all different kinds of cultures, people have been battling that question. You've had your own Daniel dinners, and we could even spend a whole hour talking about Daniel and his own vocation and pluralizing, secularizing world that he was part of in Babylon in the 5th century. But Wilberforce and his friends had the very same question, you know, millennia and a half later. You know, how do we take this up in England of the late 18th century? So success is the weighty word here. What does it mean to be successful? I think what's intriguing about Daniel, since she started off the conversation thinking about that with me, saying you're having these dinners, I think what's fascinating is to realize that when Daniel was, you know, the story that unfolds in the first half of the book is of Daniel, of course, stolen away as a captive, a refugee, political refugee from his own world, and he's picked out as one of the brightest and the best of the next generation of these, you know, slaves or whatever they were going to be seen as, the Hebrew people were. But he, you know, he's smart and he's physically fit, I'm sure, and he's got good EQ, and, you know, and he sort of picked out to go to the King's School. We have a King's School here in Washington, D.C. that many senators and presidents over the years have gone to. It's called St. Albans School. You know, every nation of the earth has, you know, a King's School. Eton is this way in England, and, you know, and it's a King's School, and there have always been schools like that where people are prepared for political, social leadership in the next generation. Daniel was picked out for that. It'd be a misreading, though, of his life, just to cut to the chase here, to think that what Daniel did was to spend his life creating a safe public square for Jews. Wasn't that because he was, of course, a Jew and believed religious things with his life? But then you miss the story, because the story actually is of him being the most trusted political counselor in three different mercurial regimes. Babylon was the capital of the world. So they were not good people. I mean, you could sort of think about the world we live in today or any other period of time, and sometimes people achieve political success, to use that weighty word, who aren't very good people, you know. And Nebuchadnezzar wasn't a very good person. And sometimes, you know, he would say all power and praise to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then the next day he'd create a fiery furnace. So if it's Nebuchadnezzar, then it's, you know, Belshazzar, and then it's Darius. And over the course of three different political empires, moving essentially from Iran to Iraq, to use contemporary social political terms, Daniel was chosen by these despots to be his most trusted political counselor. So what did he do? I mean, best we can understand, because it's what political counselors always do, is they give counsel, they give wisdom, they give wise words about building highways and, you know, water resources and military strength, agricultural products, and, you know, trying to make sure that the king has the best counsel he needs, you know, whatever they choose to do it or not. But their job is to be right in the middle of the push and shove of a particular social, political, economic, cultural moment in history. Political counselors do that. And Daniel did that for his whole life.
He put himself in the middle.
He put himself, but in some ways God put himself, it's sort of a sovereign work of God, of course, but it's also his own human, you know, hopes and his own abilities and his own willingness to work hard and, you know, being a good steward of his gifts. And, you know, and he's, to use a good older word here, he was extruded. This is a word of Francis Schaeffer's, actually, from years ago.
Okay.
Extruded into a position of more responsibility. And eventually becomes, you know, from this, you know, bright young man to being, you know, for decades, the most, literally, the most trusted political counselor in the Babylonian world.
So he was extruded into more responsibility.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that phrasing. Yeah.
Yeah. So what does it mean to be successful? I mean, again, the word is a weighty word, but
yeah.
I think, I mean, part of why I like Daniel so much, it'd be interesting for you to have one of your dinners about this. I mean, on the one hand, it's easier to read the first half of the book and think, well, yes, I get the, you know, the vegetables and the water, and I get the dreams, and I get the fiery furnaces and the lion's dens, and yes. The last half of the book is a harder book to read, though. And the reason it is because it's full of God's own visions given directly to Daniel. So no longer is he interpreting the dreams to the kings and the emperors, but he has his own dreams given by God. It'd be a better, happier story, Josh, if we read these dream by dream by dream chapters and said, well, isn't that clear? Boy, you know, his own sense of vocation was more clearly understood now because God spoke to him, didn't he? Instead, what we have chapter after chapter, you know, dream by dream, is the language of, and Daniel was perplexed. His face was flush. He couldn't sleep at night. You know? And literally, the very last words about Daniel in the whole book of Daniel, after all these dreams are given to him with his own name on them, literally, this is your dream, Daniel. You know, the very last words about Daniel are literally, and Daniel was perplexed. So your question about what's it mean to be successful, you know, as I said, it's a complex word, isn't it? It's a weighty word.
Yeah.
It's a pregnant word. You know, and I think in the now but not yetness of life, you know, between what we say, Jesus is come to make everything be new, and we stressed all of our hope on that. That is true, actually. But we live with all creation still groaning, you know, paying attention to the world and its brokenness and its woundedness and its sorrows, and full of hope too as it is, and realizing that, you know, we are, you know, we don't see everything fully with full clarity, and it isn't all worked out, even with our own best efforts, and our own best shots still don't always work. I mean, you just played baseball with your 3 or 4 year old son this morning with his teammates, you know, whether you're watching the Cubs or the White Sox or the Nationals. I mean, what's incredible is that the most successful hitters they have, who get paid $20 million a year for hitting what? A ball every 3 or 4 times they come to bat.
Yes.
That's kind of sobering, actually. Because they could be like the star of the stars.
Yeah.
Be like, whew, Bryce Harper up to bat again? You know, and you could pick your, you know, Cubs player like this, of course. I mean, like.
Yeah, we're definitely Cubs guys over here.
Good for you, then. You could pick, you know, the World Series champion slugger, and you think, wow. But it isn't because he hits the ball 4 out of 4 times. He's judged to be a wild success. Get paid millions of dollars because once every 3 or 4 times he hits the ball. Mm. So is he a success? Well, the world in some ways judges him to be a success. You know, I'm only saying that, you know, when we think about this in terms of biblical imagery and history, and input for our thinking, Daniel was seen to be a faithful man, having integrity. So I think the words like integrity and faithfulness and persistence and somehow melding together heart and mind or IQ and EQ, to the glory of God, that has to be seen what success is about.
I think Martin Luther King has this quote where he says, steadfast love, which implies faithfulness and all these things, will have the final say in all reality. And so I love that concept, especially thinking about the muddiness of what I think of like secular work. It is very muddy, and how do you sort of go forward in that muddiness? But what you're saying is, as a person of faith, there's an element of faithfulness and persistence that I guess is required.
Right. Well, there's no other world to live in, Josh. That's kind of the hard edge to this conversation. We don't really have any other world to live in than that. Think about your marriage to your beautiful, Puerto Rican wife. I have a little Scotch-Irish wife here in my house with me. you look across the room or however it is you met her, when I met my wife in Rocky Mountain National Park, I was enamored. I liked who she looked like and how she was when I got to talk to her and got to getting to know her the next years of life and finally saying, can we be married together? You could be enamored and, so taken and smitten, and you could use all kinds of words to describe what it is to look into the possibility of marriage to a good woman, to a beautiful woman. But what you don't understand when you're promising your heart to this person in the glory of a wedding day is it'll be glorious and it'll be ruinous too. It'll be the best thing in your life, but it'll also be probably the hardest thing in your life. And both are true at the same time. And I would just say that that's the world we live in, because it's the now but not yet of reality.
Yeah. That's pretty weighty. Yeah, glorious and ruinous at the same time. One of the things that's come up a lot in our Facebook group, or at least someone had posted this about, we were talking about our vocation, looking very specifically where we specialize, so a lawyer or a doctor. How would you say, and he referenced your book talking about how you explored the common good, not just in your profession, but as a coach, as a husband, as you alluded to. I guess what would you say about, the specifics of the profession versus the entire life? And how do you know how much to put towards the specialization of a project versus the holistic view?
That's a very, very good question, and good for your friends for wrestling with that.
Yeah, the person who asked it is he's extremely smart. He's a lawyer, so.
We had a guy come over here an hour and a half ago, and his name is Issam Youssef. He's Egyptian immigrant. He's going to do some home repair project for us outside. So we were just talking through what he would do and how much it would cost. And he'd come by a few days ago, and I talked to him. I said, but I want my wife to meet you too before we decide on this. So he came back today and we were talking, and I was explaining to my wife, and then I reiterated this to him as he was driving away. I said, Issam, what matters to me most is that you be somebody who brings together both character and competence. I need to know about you that you're a good person, an honest person, you have integrity, that your words, what you say about yourself is actually the way you do your work. But I also need to know about you that the work you do is really well done. That you actually know what you're doing. I said, think about going to the car repair shop, It isn't enough to know that they know how to do it. You want to make sure that they're going to be honest about it too,
Yeah.
My daughter, who's 28, was here for a couple days ago, lives in Charlottesville, and she was saying, Dad, I took my car to the dealer, to Toyota Highlander, and used to belong to us actually, but we sold it to her some years later, and she said, I took it to the Toyota dealership in Charlottesville. They said, oh, yes. This would be $800 for you. And she said, well, I took it home, and I was just asked my new husband, what do you think? He said, well, take it to my little shop over here because that's where I go. And it was like $250, a small, small little thing. They had to put a bolt in somewhere, There's a dissonance between character and competence there. So I think whether it's a car repairman or a home repairman or a lawyer on downtown Chicago or serving the suburbs of Chicago or an advertising executive or a nurse or a physician or a teacher or a coach or I think all of us realize in our guts that both of those matter at the same time. They both matter at the same time. And so I would say we're not all going to be, we won't always be the chief PR executive for my firm headquartered in Chicago. We serve the whole, we have offices in Singapore and in London and, Sydney and, in Chicago too. And I'm the best of the best. I mean, that isn't, I think, what all of us will end up doing in life. But I do think that in our own, trying to be good stewards of our own gifts, we're realizing that, to the best of my ability before the face of God, how do I excel at both of these at the same time? How do I grow into them, to live into them? Again, coming back to, your World Series winners, whether it's the relief pitcher at the end of the day or the cleanup batter at the end, making his way through the lineup night by night. I mean, ERA doesn't mean that every ball he throws is a strike.
Yeah.
Every batter is out. But you're judging, when all is said and done, the best ERA is a pretty good indicator of what this person's abilities are like.
Yeah.
And of course, what we're longing for, what you are hoping, this 3 or 4 year old son that you are raising right now, that in 10 years, he won't just be impressed with the guy who has the biggest muscles and who's the fastest feet in the league, but probably you're going to be telling stories over the next 10 years about somebody who's actually really good at what he does, but he's really a good person too, because you want him to be that kind of a person, to try his darndest at what he's doing, but actually for it to grow deeper, more important is what kind of person is he going to become?
Yeah. So one of the things that makes me think is, I think one of the questions that comes up a lot for us in our group is, if I think oftentimes in our culture, it's, and especially within the church, there's sort of a push that, the pastors are doing the most important work, or someone that's in a nonprofit.
With all those bags you're wrestling with.
What's that?
So go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. Is that you or me?
No, it's you. It was, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, or maybe like a nonprofit is doing the right work. And then, so, we're sort of trying to figure out how does this secular work within that place. And I know in your book, you talk about how we should see ourselves as part of the future,
The way the future turns out.
Yeah. What's that?
The way the future turns out, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, in that sense, that we're not always going to be hitting 1,000%. We should be faithful to the role we have, even if we're the relief pitcher. So how do we know if we're in the right, position? Like maybe we're the backup pitcher, but we think we could be the number one quarterback on a football team rather than a baseball team. Maybe we feel like we could be better served within a church. How do you know if you're in that sort of best position, using your gifts and serving God?
So since you introduced yourself by talking about little boys and their baseball games, I'm just going to keep this athletic for a while.
Okay? All right. I love it.
Well, I mean, you guys have had a quarterback for the Bears the last few years who everybody would say, Jay Cutler has a pretty good arm, actually, a remarkably strong arm. But nobody seems to like him, I don't know how that looked like in Chicago, but at least by watching was that his EQ wasn't very high, even though he was seen to be, a gifted quarterback, but abstracted in abstract terms. But his teammates didn't seem to like him. He didn't have a very good relationship with the fans, and I don't know him at all personally, but that just seemed to be what his reputation was like. You know, to switch teams here, I mean, coming more into the heart of your question, isn't it always in the fascinating, you know, note in history to think about Tom Brady being drafted 199th at that year or whatever it was, you know, like the last person taken, the last round of draft taken, you know. People were paid way too much money to be football scouts, you know, one after one judged that, you know, Tom Brady was really going to be an all-star man, you know. We'll give him a ball to, you know, come out and try, but I mean, he doesn't have what it's going to take actually to become what we need in the NFL. No. And I've been watching that reality for a long time, maybe you have too, of just how, what a difference it is between somebody who's on one level, who's going to have to be proven on the next level. No. Again, a Chicago story here, but I mean, mm-hmm. Cousins grew up in the Willow Creek Church for a while there in Chicago.
Yep.
The dad, one of the pastors there, moved to Holland, Michigan, and played high school and there, and then went to Michigan State. And I mean, 5 years later, what happened? Well, who were the darlings of the NFL draft? You know, it's a quarterback from Stanford.
Kirk Cousins.
Well, a quarterback for Stanford, and then one from Baylor. And they were the 1-2, you know, who's the best? And, of course, the Colts got one of them, and then the Redskins got the other of them, RG3. They were can't-miss, you know, players. And at least, you know, the last week or two or three, the big discussion has been about how many millions of dollars is Kirk Cousins going to be paid now, and because he's got the Redskins by the throat. You know, it would have been hardly anybody thought that 6 years ago he would still be in the NFL, much less be, you know, commanding gazillions of dollars for his ability to throw football. You know, and so in some ways, this idea of, you know, of judging who will be successful and persisting at it and contributing to a wider world, we don't know that until we see how it gets worked out.
Yeah, so just because you're currently the backup, you know, right-hand yeah. pitcher,
right.
Don't just turn and give up just because you feel like your heart might be in the wrong place, or, you know, maybe you should be in a different role, because there's a lot to be said about persistence.
And that's coming back to Schaefer's imagery of extrusion, being extruded. I mean, the opposite of extrusion is intrusion. So, you know, we all know what it looks like in an organization or, you know, wherever it is we're looking, institution of any sort, when somebody intrudes, you know, out of their own self, you know, glamorization or their own sense of importance, or, you know, I deserve this. If only you knew this about me, you know, I can connive and manipulate, and I'm really good at this, and I can get myself into the position of being, you know, the most prominent person because I deserve that kind of recognition, actually. That's always awkward and uncomfortable, I would say. That's different than the person who, you know, is really good at it, what they do, and they, with humility, honest humility, they serve other people around them. And I passed around to a group I'm a part of recently called the Praxis Labs, an essay from Harvard Business Review a week or two ago. But it was looking at this dynamic of, you know, in life all the time, but right now, you know, maybe it's its own poignancy and urgency. But why it is we choose jerks who are full of themselves to give leadership to us? People who are so sort of, in a sense, sort of have a certain charisma about them, but it's always full of self, actually. But we want that kind of leader typically, whereas everybody actually looks at long-term socialist health of the social ecology of organizations and institutions, sees actually that it's leaders who are servant leaders who actually create healthy organizations.
Mm. Yeah, versus the charismatic, you know, it's like the good to great kind of concept.
I mean, in some ways, again, the weighty words are, what does it mean to be great? You know, I mean, you could be an honest movement from good to great,
mm-hmm.
but great isn't because you have a sense of, I am great after all.
Mm-hmm. How do you balance that? Like, and I guess if you're in that position where you're maybe the backup quarterback, you know, keeping it baseball related, but you feel like you're better than that first guy. But at the end of the day, as people of faith, you know, we should be looking at the common good. And then there's a sort of a balance of, well, if I do think I'm better, then it would be better for the common good. However, that can be a prideful thing as well. How do you balance that? How do you, you know, balance being your own arrogance and your own pride, which is going to be coming up constantly, versus, you know, going to the fullest of your potential and maybe going to the next team?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know the interior life of Tom Brady. Okay, I don't really. I watch the exterior world that he seems to live in, and you know, he's made way, 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 way more money than I will in this life, and he has a model for a wife, and he has mansions on different coasts of the world, and I mean, he sort of succeeded, hasn't he? What's remarkable, of course, is that somehow the combination of Bill Belichick and, you know, Mr. Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, and Tom Brady, they've been able to keep a healthy team alive for much longer than anybody would expect, actually. I mean, who knows how long it's going to last, whether Brady will be done in 2 years or 5 years. I don't know, really. But he still, you know, was the MVP one more time again of the team that, you know, surprisingly came back in the last, you know, 12 minutes of the game and surprised everybody, you know, in the Super Bowl this year. But somehow the sense of team that the Patriots seem to create is healthy. I mean, people come in and out and people stay a year or two sometimes, but I mean, they've had a remarkable longevity as a team. And you can't do that I'll use this again, these kind of important couple words together, unless there's a healthy social ecology. Unless there's a sense of that we belong to each other, that we are willing to serve each other. I'm willing to restructure my salary for the sake of the common good, you know, so the sake of the fact that everybody else gets money, get paid too. I'll rethink the deal you offered me. And, you know, on the market terms, I was worth it, okay? But because, you see, I want to have other players play with me, I will have to actually restructure the terms of my own contract, which I will do because I want the team as a team to succeed.
Yeah, and that kind of ties into before the conversation we started recording out, you were speaking about finding a home before finding a neighbor and then finding a home. How do you relate that? I mean, is that, you know, because if you have a healthy social ecology and a team sense, you're giving for one another for your own specialization, but also maybe for your community?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I never would say that the Clapham Credo or the words we've lived with from that are a biblical absolute, that all of God's people will live this way all the time, everywhere. I never would ever say that, Josh. I would say that it's born, though, of maybe something like some marrying of longing and hope and of necessity and grace, that, you know, to think, okay, Chicago, here I come, you know. Where do I want to live, you know? And, you know, we'll find the house I want to be, and then we'll look to see, you know, whatever happens really. I mean, again, this is not a biblical absolute. I would always distinguish between that and the rest of life. But, again, it's not because we are perfect at this at all, because we never have been. But always for us has been the question since we first were married, who do we know who lives where? And could we find a place to live that's near people who we already have some sense of a camaraderie with? Even though we may not be literally neighbors next door, but could we be within walking distance or within a 2 or 3 minute drive of people that we actually know something about? Because again, in a small town of 500 people, maybe that isn't quite the same need you have. But when you begin to move into the Chicagos or the Washingtons of the world, they're just too big, you know. It's so easy to be anonymous. And what's the great curse of, you know, Chicagoland? That people don't know each other, then therefore they don't care about each other. And if you go back to the Visions book and its argument about the relation, this Hebrew epistemology, the Hebrew way of knowing, it to know is to care. And it's built, of course, on God's own knowledge of us, and therefore God cares about us. So to know and to care, to be in relationship with and to be responsible for, are bound up together, actually. And so if you think about, you know, the first criteria for me always is going to be, you know, I'll find the house I want to live in, then other things will fall into place. You know, maybe they will, probably they won't actually. And so how are you going to, you know, for me, the idea is, would you be willing to submit your decision-making to the decision-making of other people, not because you want to share towels and toothbrushes, that's not what I'm talking about here, but how would you have some, you know, even if it's frail, even if it's finite, how would you have some sense that we've chosen to try to live in the vastness of this complex metropolitan world with some sense of relationship and responsibility to each other?
Yeah, that I mean, I love that idea, and it ties into the to your book. I mean, to like God knows us and loves us. How do we know the world and love the world? Wow, that's really good. And then what, in terms of practical things to do that, you know, I'm just thinking, it's very easy to get into, you know, especially with kids, you get into the games and the this, and you're constantly doing things. And sometimes, at least me, I just feel like I'm exhausted at the end of the day. Or what are like practical things that you would say to, you know, maybe a group of young men and women, you know, 25 to 40 that are in that period of life that love God with all their hearts, but also are kind of exhausted from everything. Like, what are some practical things that you would recommend?
I mean, one practical reality, Josh, is that that's just true, isn't it? You know, right? I mean, it wasn't true in the same way when you were 19, when you're 22, but now that you're no longer that age in life, and now you're 30 and 35 and 40, and, you know, and you've got a wife and you've got a child and you've got a house and, you know, and you got a young job and you're trying to do well in it and, you know, be successful in it, to use that good word. You know, I mean, you realize that it only gets more complicated in some ways. It's hard to persuade the 22-year-old just out of college, you know, young man or woman, that life gets busier and harder. You know, but now that you've gone through your 20s, you realize it did, actually. You know, I couldn't have imagined that it would have, but it really does, doesn't it? You know, and because it just does. And when it gets to be 35 and 45, it just gets more complex in some ways. But I would say that's true. But it's also, in some sense, to realize that there are seasons to life too. Now, on the one hand, when you've got babies with diapers, you think, if I could only get him out of his diapers, then my life would change, actually. And then you realize that when they get to be 10, there are other complexities. You know, when they get to be 17, there are other things you weren't thinking about, and that becomes complex and challenging and hard for you. And they get to be 24, and there's even a different set of complexities, you know. Over time, Josh, I began to describe my life to people this way. This was years and years ago, and it's still true in some ways. But people would say, "How are you doing, Steve? How are your kids doing?" You know, and I would always say something like this: "I wake in the morning with my children in my throat, just that I would be thinking about them and praying for them and worrying about them and hoping for them, and you know, and I didn't know how else to live my life other than to say it that way." Actually,
and how many kids do you have?
We have five.
Oh wow! Okay, what do you mean by that? With my children in your throat? My first thought was you wake up and they're choking you, like, "Wake up, Dad!"
Well, I mean, that would be literally in some ways. This is more metaphorically. It's more like, you know, you just, you know, your throat constricts because your children are so heavy on your heart. You know, their hopes, their futures, their livelihoods, their loves, their flourishing, you know, it matters so much to you as a father, you know. And there's hardly anything other than having a healthy marriage. There's anything in your life that matters more to you than that.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, it has meaning for you with a 3 or 4 year old, 5 year old boy in his baseball, little t-ball games or whatever they are. And that's different than when he gets to be 10, and, you know, and you're hoping that he's not sitting on the bench the whole time, because that's part of, you know, his happiness and your happiness too. You know, when he gets to be 14 and, you know, does he still want to play baseball? Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't anymore, really.
You know? Yeah, I've been noticing that with him. I love baseball growing up. That was my life growing up. That was all I cared about. And he likes it, and he's pretty good at it, but he would rather play Legos and draw any day. Yeah. That's just what he loves, and he tells me that. So yeah. So it's interesting to see, like, what, how do you encourage those things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that'll be, in some ways, Josh, my friend who I'm getting to know right now,
yeah,
in ways that's only going to become more complex for you, I'm guessing, as your relationship to him grows in complexity and you begin to understand more the nuances of his own little person in the world, you know. And in some ways, he may be, you know, in 10 years, 15 years, your favorite Cubs, you know, fan, you know, that you love to go to games together. That would be maybe what happens in 20 years. I don't know, really.
Yeah.
You know? But it may be that he says to you when he's 17, I don't really like this as much as I used to, Dad, you know?
Yeah.
I'd really, really rather do this. Can we do this instead? Or, you know, I mean, whatever it's going to turn out to be, I have no idea, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say whether it's for you or for your wife, I mean, there are things that are busy about nursing a baby that don't last forever, of course.
Yeah.
You know, the same demands are not the same demands when you have a baby in arms as they are when you've got a toddler in arms or when you've got a five-year-old or a 10-year-old. It just changes, of course. You know? So I would say that on the one hand, there's a having to make peace with the seasons of life, and those are different in one's life. Your newly married years, you're no longer in them in some ways because you've now got a kid, you know, and you're no longer newlyweds and full of time and passion and, you know, just the two of you. And, you know, now you've got somebody else to watch out for too in your life. It just complicates things, really. You know? And the challenge to me is, you know, is how do you keep at your commitments over the course of your life? That's really, I mean, if you've read the Visions of Vocation book, I read another book some years ago called The Fabric of Faithfulness, which has that as its central question. How do you deepen your commitments over life rather than discard them? Because what I began to notice was that the years between 20 and 40 were negotiating years for the rest of life. They were negotiating, what am I going to care about? You know, what am I going to give myself to? What am I going to believe in? What am I going to, you know, work towards? And, you know, the sad reality is that most people who seem to be to start off well, whether it's the RG3s of the world or the Jay Cutlers of the world, you can pick your, again, athletic analogies here. People who start off well, most people don't actually keep going. They don't have the staying power. And so how do you be somebody who develops habits of heart in these years between, you know, emerging adulthood and the coming into a more full adulthood? How do you be somebody at age 40 who has deepened his loves, his commitments, rather than deciding over the course of those years, you know, when I was 21 and so naive and so innocent and I didn't know, but, you know, I'm not a kid anymore. You can't think that way. You sure can't live like that, you know. Because I've seen enough of the world now, and it isn't like that, you know. And I'm not like that anymore. You know? But you also, as you describe you and your peers as being people who love God with all of your heart, and you want to be good fathers and good husbands and good in your work and good neighbors and friends, you know. So you've seen that there's something about that kind of a life that you long for. Well, my longer question of my life has always been, to use a good word here, vocation is a big word. It's a complex word. It's more than my work. It's more than my occupation. Vocation is, who am I in the world? And so how do you form habits of heart that keep the who am I with its own integrity that can be sustained through the push and shove of the years of life?
Yeah, I love that, because, and that's really one of the reasons I'm having these interviews, and because this could just be a group of guys, and but I'm also trying to reach out to people like yourself and others that have really studied this, because I feel like I'm in a position where I'm 30 years old. I've had a pretty successful, you know, sales career, you know, successful, the loaded word, you know, but then what's next, you know,
yeah.
You know, and do you go into, like, my dad hit a point where he decided to go into missions. From the business world, you know, so I'm kind of discovering what's that next step. And I feel like a lot of people in our group are in a similar place. Like, what's that next thing? Do we go into management? Do we go into, you know, what's the sort of section? And I love that habits of heart idea that can be sustained. So could you speak to that? Like, is that having a devotion, you know, every day? Or is that, how do you deepen your loves? How do you create those habits of heart, you know?
Yeah. Well, St. Augustine is probably the place to begin here in one sense, if we can take him as being early on in the church's history. I mean, if you go back to Jesus, and, you know, which we should, probably always ought to do, you know, what's the most important thing in the whole world, Josh and Steve? It's make sure that your loves are the right loves.
Mm.
That you love God and you love your neighbors, you love yourself. So those are the most central issues of your life and mine. Get your loves ordered rightly. So the best teaching in the history of the church for 2,000 years has always been focused on the ordering of our loves. There's a good Latin way to talk about that, but we can just use English here. It's the ordering of loves, which is the longest discussion about discipleship in the history of the church. It goes back 2,000 years, really. Getting your loves ordered rightly. St. Augustine, you know, asked by a businessman kind of like yourself, Josh, to put it in your own 21st century terms, but he was asked by a guy named Laurentius in the 5th century. He was a businessman in Rome who was watching Roman civilization begin to teeter and to begin to implode. And he wrote Augustine and said, "What's going on in the world, Augustine? You're the teacher, you know, you're the bishop. You know, what do Christians think about the world that can make sense of a falling apart world? Because we've been the empire, the great empire, for centuries. It seems to be falling apart." Now, he had no categories to look back on to say this was the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. He was just watching his world fall apart. And Augustine said back to him, actually a letter he wrote, it became published over time in a little booklet called the Enchiridion, which is a Latin word for the handbook.
Did you say Enchiridion?
The Enchiridion, E-N-C-H-I-R. R-I-D-I-O-N, Enchiridion. He said, well, the Christians believe in three things that gives us ways to understand ourselves in the world. He walks through the Lord's Prayer, sort of prayer by prayer, petition by petition. He says, we believe in, you know, the Apostles' Creed, he said. It shapes our thinking about these realities in this way. He says, we also believe in the theological virtues of faith and hope and love. And all of these are important, he argues, and they are, of course. But he says it's a mistake to think that if I asked you, Josh Ballantyne, you know, thinking I would really get to know you if I said, what do you believe, actually, Josh? And depending on who you were, what we're talking about, you might say, well, I believe in this, I believe in this, I believe in this, really. But Augustine says, well, that's an interesting conversation to have, but you don't really get to know Josh when you ask him the question, what do you believe? And he presses this out through faith, hope, and love. And finally he says, you only really begin to get to know Josh or Steve if you ask the question, so what do you love? What do you love? And he argues that actually that's the deepest of all the questions. I would simply say that over the course of 1,500 years since then, you know, 1,000 years since then, I guess now, I mean, what the church has been always more interested in is the ordering of our loves. We will love. But what is sin? I mean, fundamentally, it's a disordering of loves. It's a getting the loves in the wrong, getting the right loves done wrongly. It's misreading the loves. It's misappropriating. It's distorting the loves. You know, money is never the worst thing in the world. To love money can be a problem. You know, sex is never a bad thing in the world, really. To love that over the tenderness and care and stewardship of your wife's health and hope and sleep and, you know, happiness. I mean, you're not, you know, it's getting the right loves in the right way, in the right order. Mm. So work matters. It does matter. But if it's made to be the only thing that matters, well, I mean, what happens is that 10, 15, 20 years later, either the marriage begins to disintegrate and fall apart, or the person begins to be, you know, 55 and said, well, I have been successful, but sheesh, you know, my kids hate me, you know, and I lost my family, you know. I made all the money we needed to go to, you know, Aspen every summer, you know. But boy, I wish I had a family still, you know. So it's making sure that we understand what is worth loving and loving it in the right way, which is what I would say is the language of habits of the heart. Again, this first book, The Fabric of Faithfulness, a book which looks at that explicitly and, you know, frontally, actually. And I argue that people who keep on keeping on through life are marked by three habits of heart. One is that, you know, they begin to form a set of convictions about who God is, who I am, you know, what the world is like, that can make sense of what I believe in an increasingly pluralizing world. So getting the worldview right, or the convictions right, or the commitments right, is important. But a second quality or character, I argued, was that people, because we're just made the way we are, we need to see that words can become flesh to believe them to be true. Which is why the incarnation is not only good theology, but actually it's the best pedagogy. It's the best teaching. It's the best way to learn. You don't believe anything to be true, Josh. Unless somebody just says, well, you know, I read this in a book. And you, your first question, either in your own mind or to the person, is going to be, but did anybody ever work it out in life? Did it ever happen?
Yeah, like the rubber meeting the road.
Rubber ever meet the road on this one, or is this just an idea? Mm-hmm. And so what the second quality is that we have to see a person live like this. So it's the idea of a mentor or a teacher. So this, to be somebody who actually grows into convictions that last for life, you need to find people along the way who can show you that good people, serious people, actually live their lives like this. It isn't just an idea. These aren't just words. But the people I respect, that I like, actually live this way. And you watch it be worked out in life.
Mm.
The third quality that I began to hear in my reading and study was that people who kept at it over a lifetime kept making choices to do what you've been doing the last few years of life, Josh. You know, you're 30 years old, you know, and your first, you know, communication with me was, I have some friends. We've been reading together. The third one is community. That it's a decision to commit yourself to kindred spirits, people of like heart and like mind who choose to live out a life together. Because that is sustaining when all is said and done.
I love that. Yeah. So it's first basically discovering what those convictions are, knowing who we are, who God is, but then putting the rubber to the road, finding people actually do it, having those mentors, that have people that have actually done it. The word became flesh, and then community. So would that be like more like peers, you know?
So peers, and probably be a healthy community probably is both peers and older and younger over time, you know? But yeah, peers, especially people of like heart, like mind, who in some ways you were able to walk through life together with. So that's why for me this language of, or this imagery from Clapham 200 years ago, choose a neighbor before you choose a house. It's just recognizing that, you know, we need people of kindred spirit, of like commitments, of like heart, just to, in some ways, to week by week by week by week to say, I'm still at this. I hope you are. I'm still at this. I need you to be.
Oh, that's really good. I definitely want to be cognizant of your time because I know you have a ton of things that you got to get to. How can we find out more about the Washington Institute? What kind of things are you doing that we should be aware of and follow?
It's a good question and a very kind question. But you probably should know that, you know, I'm making this transition from Washington Institute to Regent College in the next few months. So the work of the Washington Institute is going to be subsumed into the life and work of Regent College. Regent is an unusual institution in the world because it's not a seminary. So it's not like Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, which is a good school, or it isn't, not like Wheaton College, or, you know, it isn't like, you know, a seminary in that sense. It's a graduate school. It's only a graduate school. But it exists for people just like you, to emphasize three words here. People who actually have lives in the marketplace. but who want what you guys want, obviously. And that's been intriguing to me, Josh. They want theological deepening to go back into the world of work. That's why Regent exists, actually. That's why it was brought into being. So in my course last summer, this all started for me by teaching a course last summer at Regent, a week-long course. I called it Vocation as Common Grace for the Common Good. And in my class, for people from all over the world, there was a businessman from Sydney, Australia, and a Deloitte consultant from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and a young business couple from Hong Kong, and a mathematics PhD from Lausanne, Switzerland, and a pastor from Miami, Florida, and a CEO of a corporation in Nashville, and all over the place, actually. But one was the chairman of the board of Regent College, a businessman in Calgary, Alberta, sort of a global oil and gas company. And end of the week, he said to me, "Can you talk to me and the president?" I said, "Okay." And they said, "Would you ever be willing to do more things for us?" I said, "Well, like what?" I said, "Well, maybe you could speak on our behalf." I said, "I think uniquely of you in the world, I would do that with gladness, actually. I think very highly of who you are." That conversation went on literally every week for 6 months until finally November, the question was, "Would you ever be willing to teach for us?" And I literally said back to them, "I planted 4 trees in my yard this year. I don't know, really." But a month later, I was up there for a day. We talked for 24 hours. And at the end of the 24 hours, the president said, "How could we press more fully into this with you? Because we want to." And I said, "You'd have to meet my friends then." So we flew out to Washington for a day in January, and we spent all day with my friends just talking about what this would mean communally, for all of us. For my wife and I, of course, but not only just for us, but because we are people who've chosen to live within a community, what would it mean for other people too? And then for the next 3 months, I began to, respond more concretely to questions they had of me. Because I still had said, "I'm not saying I will do this yet, but I will respond to these questions you have for me." And then finally, in end of April, I guess probably it was, the Board of Governors of Regent said, "We'd like you to take up this position of Professor of Marketplace Theology and Leadership." And for 2 more weeks, Meg and I just talked and talked and prayed and prayed and thought about it and thought about it, and finally said yes to them. So in September, I will become Professor of Marketplace Theology and Leadership, and hope I have people like you who come into these classes I'm teaching.
So you said to come meet your friends?
Yeah.
And what did your friends say?
I mean, they gathered together for some hours on a Saturday, and we just sat in a room together, about 15 or 20 of them, with the president of Regent College, and they all went around introducing themselves to him and explaining who they were in relation to Meg and me, why their friendship mattered to them, to us all together.
And how many people, I'm just so curious because I was not expecting you to say that. How many people were that gathered?
Probably 15 or 20.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And then, then he introduced himself to them and explained why they were interested in me coming to do this and, what Regent was about. Some of them knew, but some didn't in all that way. But even then, it wasn't a done deal because we still had to kind of think it through, for the next 2 months. And
yeah, they were part of the vetting process for you to really go to the next steps.
Yeah, right.
Wow, that's interesting. I think that's that community aspect.
It is really. It's giving concreteness to that, so it's just more than just an idea.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Garber, I really appreciate your time. I mean, you've been more than generous, and we really appreciate all the work you've done and how you've contributed to, what other people are trying to discover and to align the desires of our heart with, to where they need to be. So really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Josh. I mean, you should know from my perspective that to have people like you and your friends read this so carefully as you have is really the best gift that I get in all this. So thank you.
Oh, no, absolutely. Well, I'll let you get back and, love to stay in touch. And as you go across in your move and move into Regent in the next phase of your life.
Thank you.
All right, Dr. Garber. Well, have a great day, sir.
Okay. God bless you. Thank you so much.
You too. Yeah. All right. Bye.